Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Keenan Evansby, a sports journalist at Daily Maverick, and I'm so privileged to be joined by the incredible Rebecca Achieng Ajulu-Bushell. She's currently the CEO of a burgeoning nonprofit organization. She was also a world-class swimmer, but right now she's joining me to speak about her raw, intimate, an enthralling book about her life titled These Heavy Black Bones. Welcome, Rebecca, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Awesome. These Heavy Black Bones tackles a myriad of topics of a young mixed race girl growing up in Kenya, South Africa, and across England as well, and feeling like she doesn't belong. The writing's absolutely exceptional. It's a deep dive, pardon the pun, into your adolescence, focusing on your experience at a swimming club in Plymouth, where you developed into a world-class swimmer and eventually becoming the first black woman to swim for Great Britain. But obviously, you step away from swimming before the London 2012 Olympic Games. And in that, one journalist writes, and he writes, when referencing you, he says, it's a home Olympic Games, and he puts that in inverted commas to describe the Games. Could you maybe just talk about that, that being in Kenya, being in South Africa, being in England, and that home, as the journalist puts it, which annoys you, and not having that sort of one place and growing up in one place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's such a great overview of the book, and thank you so much for saying such lovely things. That never gets old. I think what's interesting about being mixed race as a teenager is that you think that you are on a journey to somewhere in terms of identity. And I don't think anyone's identity is fixed, but being mixed race, you occupy that in-betweenness your whole life, and you can't get away from that. And so growing up in Kenya, when I would go home to the village where my father is from, they would say Muzungu, which means white person. And I would think, who are they talking about? And then I was like, oh, they're talking about me. And then I lived in Cape Town for a couple of years in my early teens. And I was often mistaken as being Cape colored. And I didn't really understand what that meant. And from an ethno-heritage perspective or political perspective. And then I went to the UK and I was black for the first time in my life. And I think that, I mean, being half Kenyan, half British, you know, one half of me colonized the other. And so there's that violence that you feel inside you all the time anyway. But I think when you're a teenager, as I was at that point in my life, I was about 15, 16, you know, you just want to fit in, right? That's the thing that is most salient to how you experience the world. You don't want to be different. And so navigating not just kind of being on a world stage, but also grappling with my identity, with people saying, I think another journalist wrote, you know, she speaks with a cut glass British accent. And I think, you know, I'm English. I have an English passport. I was born here. You know, how else would you expect me to speak? And it's not until much later when I was writing the book that you kind of understand this stuff for the pernicious kind of racial undertone that it has. And it is, you know, the way that media upholds the status quo is very powerful and can often be very subtle. But I didn't understand any of that when I was 15, 16. I just wanted to swim fast and win medals.
Yeah. If I could just read a quick a quote you use from Langston Hughes, which I felt like surmised what you're trying to say really beautifully in like four short lines. Then I stood out on a prairie, and as far as I could see, wasn't nobody on that prairie that looked like me. And I felt like you also mentioned that now in Kenya being seen as white, in South Africa, in Cape Town being seen as Cape colored, and then in England being seen as black, and there's just no one that was quite like you growing up and not seeing that around you. And you also speak about the internalized racism that comes with that. And I just wanted to ask, having read your book and your journey as an adolescent, about how that journey has traveled with you and how you've overcome that journey, and if that's something you've battled through today as you journey through life at the moment, and what did it take for you to work through that?
That's such a beautiful question. I think you know, certainly self-acceptance is an endless, I think, voyage that everybody is on. And, you know, I'm no different to that. But as I came of age and walked away from the pool, I think I found, and so much so through my father, who was a freedom fighter and struggled against apartheid in South Africa, he would always say, you know, the function of freedom is to free others. And I think I've found the easiest way of understanding my struggle in the world is to not think about myself, but to think about the people who struggle more than me. And so I've been fortunate enough to have a great education. My parents sacrificed a lot for me to have the opportunities that I did. And I also benefit from a colorism that means that a more acceptable face of diversity than darker skinned Black women. And so I think for me, it's a case of when I have a seat at the table, I'm also there on behalf of other people who don't or can't be in that room. And it's a very easy responsibility. So I recognize that I'll always be a kind of translator between these two worlds, my two worlds. I grew up in a very white world. I'm also Kenyan, and that's where I'm from. That will always be home to me in a way. And I think, yeah, what a privilege to be so amorphous.
Yeah, it is beautiful. And your journey is beautiful. You also, you as I alluded to earlier, you wear many hats. You are different people. You've done different things. But in doing those different things, you've also remained extremely sort of intense, as you described it, in what you do, and like sort of going all out and not leaving anything behind you. You do everything to the best of your ability. And I just, like, obviously you made it to the pinnacle of your sport, and you were the best that there ever was. And where does that, do you think, stem from, where that intensity, that drive to leave everything out there, and sort of your ability to ignore everything outside of that and pretend that it doesn't exist and just solely focus on what you want to focus on and what you want to achieve?
I've never articulated a good answer to this question, but I think it definitely has to do with the intensity that I was born out of. My mom had me when she was very young, and she grew up with not very much in the north of England. And I think she fought hard to change her circumstances and to get out of the place that she came from. And my father was in prison when I was born, detained during the apartheid regime here, or there rather, in South Africa. And I guess I grew up with two people who in different ways told me I could do whatever I wanted and I could be whatever I wanted to be. And then I also grew up with my father's absence. And I think that was a well inside myself that I've always been trying to fill. And the best way that I knew how to fill it, I guess, was to be great and to be undeniable. And it has never occurred to me to do anything in a different kind of way. It's never occurred to me to not do everything. You know, I remember when I made my first film, I used to be in production and still kind of adjacent to the creative space. I remember calling my mom and saying, you know, we're going to make it to the Oscar specifications because I just really think this is important for film festivals. And she was like, you're 23 years old. Like, what are you? And I was like, well, you know, you got to do it. You've got to do it, and you've got to believe it. And I always have done. And I think I probably owe my parents a huge debt of gratitude for that. Not that that belief shielded me from the gender or racial politics that everyone experiences. That stuff has still put hurdles in front of every path they've taken. But I don't know. I think if you're going to try, go all the way.
It's interesting you mentioned being on the phone with your mom and getting to know you through this novel. That's a motif. It's something that comes up often, you being on the phone with her and speaking to her on the phone. And it tells the story of sort of how you didn't grow up with her in front of you and in person. And obviously your dad has lived in South Africa, eventually married Lindiwe Sisulu and had his life here with his own family and his own kids with her. And you had your mom also who cared for your two little sisters in Kenya, eventually moving back to England. But in that, you were not there. You were on your own, especially in Plymouth. You were finding yourself in your own way through not having your family there. Could you just sort of touch on that and how tough it was growing up as a naive 12 year old and figuring things out on your own by yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really the duality of all of our experiences, right? Everyone feels alone, and we are alone, and we're also not alone. We're surrounded by the community that we've chosen and the people that have brought us into this world and the people that we're responsible for. But I think it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, you know, no one on the prairie looking like you. I think I've always felt especially alone. And so a lot of the book is a meditation on solitude. And I think solitude at a young age is an even more intense and kind of radical experience. So for me, there was obviously that experience of being the only person on poolside who looked like me 99% of the time, which was so strange having grown up in Kenya and pools and water being filled with people with even kind of darker mahogany skin than I have. And then going into this world where it was completely untrue. It wasn't just that there weren't black people. It was that black people couldn't swim. That was a belief that people held. That was a mythology that, you know, people really believed. And I think also there was the culture shock of being in the Western world for the first time. I think I was 13 when I moved to the UK. And, you know, I was still barefoot and climbing trees. And I had a very different childhood to the people that I was surrounded by. So I think solitude has made me tough, really tough. And I wonder what I would be like without that toughness.
And then obviously you reached the pinnacle of the sport as the number one in the world at the time. And you were very young in that. And you had a coach, Rowan, who you had a complicated relationship with, to say the least. But it turned out that he was essentially just using, as you described, your body as a vessel to progress his own career. A relationship that was quite toxic at the end and played a big role in also you leaving the sport. Could you speak about that mental hardship that you had to conquer also at that young age, all on your own, in that solitude that you speak of?
Yeah, I think that the book asks a very salient question of sporting institutions and of consent and that relationship between coach and child athlete. You know, my friend put it really well. You know, we're trying to make children into champions, and you don't really consent to that. It just kind of happens to you, and you navigate it in the best way you know how. And there's no blueprint. You know, we've seen stories come out in gymnastics. There's stories breaking in swimming now about what these relationships and the harms and abuse that they create can, you know, they leave scars, and there is a legacy of, I guess, people being pushed beyond what might be reasonably acceptable. And I never wanted to bring, I didn't want to bring a huge amount of morality to the book, because I still don't believe that as humans, we're going to stop trying to break the records of people who have gone before us. And in order to be the best, there's a certain amount of, this is what it takes, which is a kind of trope that I return to a lot in the book. You know, my relationship with my coach and him telling me this is what it takes, and me starting to believe this is what it takes, the sacrifices, the injury, the exhaustion, the sadness, the devastation of being alone or of losing or of feeling like you don't have any friends, but you believe that this is what it takes. And I don't know if there's an answer to the question. Certainly there's a line, and we need to stop people from crossing it, especially when it comes to child athletes. But as I say at the end of the book, without spoiling it for anyone, despite all of the things that I went through and despite the toxicity of that relationship, which I did get away from, you know, I would do it all again just to feel the high of the perfect race and to feel my body in perfect communion with the water. And I think that that's like the book is really a meditation on that relationship more than anything else. And it's, but there is an important politics there. And I think it's important that athletes are encouraged to talk about these relationships more. And that's the way that we see early warning signs. That's the way that we make things better as we move forwards. But, you know, we were trying to be the best in the world and it came with all the horror baked in.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the start of your journey with water is being in the pool, being in a lake, and just with the floaties on your arms, you describe it as, and just falling in love and becoming one with the water. It's not competitive swimming is not where you sort of love for the water is. It's actually in the ocean, in the lakes. It's just being one with the water and becoming one with the water. But eventually it develops into this competitive nature, and that's what you are sort of trained into becoming. And you swim for Kenya, you do well, but you don't, that's not the pinnacle for you. You don't see it as even that important. It's just another thing. And looking back into the person you've become since having studied, obviously, politics and become more socially aware, just looking back at that as a teenager and reflecting on seeing that as sort of less than representing for Kenya, just how do you reconcile that as the person you are today?
You know, I've been talking about this book for over a year now, and I've never been asked that question before, so thank you. I wonder how much responsibility I can hold my 14, 15-year-old self to for being unable to understand the kind of unequal resource allocation that exists between my continent, Africa, and, you know, the Western world that has created that structure. And I think that when you're inside sport, there is always this push towards the places and spaces that will make you the best. And I think that that was encouraged by all of the people around me, even my coaches in Kenya and South Africa as well. So it wasn't just a mentality I held because I had internalized a level of racism or because I, you know, wanted this proximity to whiteness. It was because I hadn't seen Lyndall Pool until I was 13 years old. You know, I went to the UK and it's people think that success is made up of talent and hard work, but it's not just those two things. There's a secret third ingredient, which is investment and opportunity. And when it came to sport, that was the swimming pools and the coaches and the training techniques and the gym and the nutrition and the sports psychologist and all of these things that create hierarchy. And I'm so sad for myself. I guess how strongly I feel about my Kenyan heritage now, especially now that my dad has passed away and he's buried in Kenya, in our family homeland, that I wasn't able to relish in those firsts and feel the sense of pride that I should have done. And it's difficult because I feel so far away from that. It feels like another lifetime ago that even in writing the book, I couldn't fully relive those moments. So it's, you know, it is a shame the ways that narratives about the world and unequal resources can have a huge impact on young lives. It's something I'll never get back, and I have to live with that as well.
Yeah, and it's the title of the book, These Heavy Black Bones. It's something you carry on with you, and it's part of who you are and who you've become. And in saying that, you go from Kenya representing Kenya, although you train in at the boarding school in Plymouth, obviously, but you represent them, and then sort of without your knowledge, you was preserved, but it just so happened, or it happens, and you find out that you'll be representing Great Britain, and you do some media work is done, and your mom says something. She says, she speaks about you, and she speaks about how important it is for you to do this, but she also says it will give people the opportunity to recognize or see a black swimmer succeed, or and you carry that, and you mention that it's the first time that she said that. She's first time she said you're a black woman, even though she's cared for the little girls behind you from the age of 3, and she's cared for you, and she's aware of who you are, but you've never heard her say that out loud before. And just to hear your, for those who don't know, your mom's obviously a white woman, for you to hear that, or to read that, just how does that like change you and your perspective of how you view her and how she views you?
It's funny how much the way that I grew up, and that was very much in a white world, in a white expat world in Kenya, actually, despite the fact that, you know, I was living and growing up in the place where I'm from. We didn't talk about blackness enough, my mom and I, when I was growing up. And I also didn't have a political understanding of what it meant, obviously. I was a child. But I wonder where I was encouraged to speak about myself as being mixed race, as if that was a rejection of blackness, as if that wasn't kind of part of the whole thing. It would seem so strange now not to say that I was black. I am a black woman first and foremost. And so that was an awakening, I think, and something that pushed me to reckon with the things that I believed about myself and where I got those beliefs from. You know, were they from watching Disney movies when I was growing up? Were they from, you know, growing up with two sisters who were white because of my mom, my stepdad? Was it because that language wasn't encouraged, not for malicious reasons, but just because maybe it was too hard to put words around this thing? And I think, I don't know. I wonder if my mom and I will ever find the right words for that. But definitely there's a shared understanding of who I am. And she's never not encouraged me to find my identity. And I think as that's changed and I've, you know, become somebody who identifies more and more with my Kenyan heritage and my father's history, she's been so supportive of that and of me, and is my biggest supporter. But I don't know if that generation had enough tools or education to kind of do that well. And I wonder if we will, as the world becomes more and more mixed race, will we do it better?
growing up, you in the environment that you are in Plymouth, you're the only black woman, you're the only black person in that environment, in the white environment. And you sort of want to shed the skin, and you want to fit in physically by being part of them, which is completely understandable, being a susceptible teen in an environment like that. But you grow and you change, and you start and you wear the badge of being the first black woman to represent Great Britain. You wear it as a sign of pride that you could accomplish that, and it speaks to the growth that happens to you as an adolescent and as a human being throughout the book. And it was obviously not easy, but if you could just touch on that and just the sort of acceptance, that's a big theme in the book, in acceptance in who you are, not just the color of your skin, not just that specifically, but in the person who you are, and in what your dreams are, if your dreams are yours or if they're someone else's, and finding out what exactly yours are and finding that self-acceptance. And you mentioned the meditation, but just finding that acceptance in yourself and how sort of like privileged you may feel to have found that at that age as well, when things were so fuzzy and could have possibly gone wrong.
Yeah, I wonder where that strength came from when I was 17. I'm not sure. I mean, I think my mom was somebody who was such a big proponent of my education and of reading. And we did that from my earliest years. She poured so much into me. And I think that encouragement to explore and feel the edges of the world and take on new ideas and believe that I could have a life that was as big as I wanted it to be, whether that was in or outside of the pool. I think all of that stuff kind of, I guess, supported me on that journey. And, you know, I guess I will also say, like, I didn't want to be a role model. I was 15, 16 years old. I didn't want to be singled out and titled as being different. But actually, when you are different, you're different anyway. And so it feels like a binary. You either come to accept it or you fight that forever. And so that is mine. That is my title. You know, that is my name in the annals of history. And it will be there forever because I was the first. And I'm often the first in, or the only in many of the rooms that I'm in now. Was the same when I was at university. And so, you know, why not me? And I guess when I was thinking about writing this book, maybe this is part of the answer. One of the reasons I didn't talk about my swimming career, and one of the reasons I felt like that acceptance journey probably took longer internally, was because I felt like I had to have the answers. You know, why don't Black people swim? How are we going to solve this problem? And I was like, I don't know. I'm 17 years old, you know. But then part of that acceptance is about creating that representation and sharing that experience, and then the power that that has for little girls and boys who look like me, or anyone who's struggling to find their place in the world. That encouragement to go on that journey of discovering self-love and also discovering your dreams, as you said, the ones that are truly your own, and that you will disappoint people often along the way to follow those things to the place that they lead. But I guess in writing the book, that was probably the kind of completed, the full circle of that self-acceptance journey, was accepting that I didn't have to have all the answers, that I am this thing and will always be the first Black woman to swim for Great Britain, but also that, you know, in sharing my story, you know, maybe that helps one other person to accept their difference or their struggle. And yeah, it's, I guess I'm hoping that that has happened, will happen, will keep happening.
Yeah. And just finally, I thought it was really special and poignant that you stepped away from swimming. That's something that happens, and I don't think it's a spoiler because it's a real life story. And you step away from swimming after grueling 17 or so years, just, and that's the only thing you know. And but the most critical thing about it is that you step away from it right before the London Olympic Games and right before the qualification for that. And but speaking to you is different, but in the book, and the way I've gotten to know you through the book, is that you had absolutely no regrets about it. And I thought that was beautiful. And that's part of that acceptance that you spoke about, that that's who you are and that's who you want to be. And at 17, you could make that decision. And I thought that was really beautiful for anyone reading the book, to read that and to see that. And you were just happy knowing that at one stage you were the best in the world, and no one could take that from you, despite what anything could happen. So that was incredible, and I really enjoyed that. So thank you for writing this book. I thought it was incredible. I also think you are a brilliant writer. It's like I mentioned at the beginning, you wear many hats. But the way this story is told is it's deeply personal, which is really special. So, and the way it's told, it's from a perspective of someone sharing really intimate details about growing up in a very unique situation. So yeah, it's congratulations once again on this incredible book.
Oh, thank you so much. No, I just to affirm what you said, I don't have any regrets. I love my life in the water, and I love that that's part of the fabric of my story. But you know, I'm so lucky to have had the opportunities that I've had to kind of have a life beyond it as well. And I think I wanted to choose for myself the life that I could have and make it as big as it could be. And being able to do that at 17 years old, you know, there's probably, I feel more pride in that than anything I achieved in the pool.
Congratulations on that then. And I hope everything goes well with everything else you've been up to with the many hats that you wear.
I'm going to choose a hat at some point and stick with it.
Thanks again, Rebecca, for joining me. And Rebecca's book, These Heavy Black Bones, is available at all good bookstores countrywide, online and in person. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.